Nigeria and all the events that happened. And so some people have actually talked about this era of France being the post-Algerian era of France.
It's a good way to put it.
Exactly, yeah. Which then results in this turmoil in France, and then Charles de Gaulle comes in as a savior and creates this kind of imperial presidency. Mm. The idea that the Fourth Republic failed because the president wasn't strong enough, wasn't imperial enough. Mm. So if you could explain a little bit in terms of what you were talking about, the idea that Hollande, and then now Macron even more, is basically ruling by decree, whether it came to the labor laws, the reform of the labor laws, whether it came to the terrorism laws after the terrorism events and all those things. I remember you did a lot of good reports about that.
Thank you.
And so on. So if you could explain the idea that all these measures that are completely unpopular, do not have popular support, being pushed through and forced upon France by the decree of somebody we don't even know who his donors are. We still don't.
Undemocratically.
If you could give a little bit more detail about it.
And then this guy is trying to tell countries like Iran or China or, you know, Venezuela, you know what democracy is. What you're talking about, the French imperial, imperial executive, imperial presidency, yes, that's the way that their system was set up. France, their executive branch has had more power than almost all of their Western counterparts for the reasons you were saying. And so there is this idea that if you are in France, you know, and you're the boss, you should have more power. However, it's really important to kind of realize that once the Lisbon Treaty started and, you know, Macron, the French president, no longer had control over his currency, over his budget, over his laws, the imperial presidency is in the past now. It's a historical footnote. Who the French president is now is more equivalent to a provincial governor, and he is beholden to Brussels, not to the French voter. And we see this all over the EU. We saw this with in Greece.
Ramin, let me just, I want to understand this correctly. Mm. So we have this idea that in the late, in the 90s and in the early 21st century, there is this idea that there has to be a neoliberal order. That system of having a welfare state that was created some sort of a level of social stability in European countries is no longer capable of why? Because all the resources are not going to the elites. So what you have is the EU imposing these rules and these regulations, and then in every country you have the local governments being the enforcers of that.
Is that precisely correct? And this is why, you know, you have voter participation plummeting in France. You know, for the legislative elections here, they were the lowest not only in the Fifth Republic, but the Third Republic, the Second Republic, because they know that people in Europe, this is what I can report being there for, you know, 13 years on the ground, they are realizing that their votes don't matter. That if they vote in a way that the oligarchy, Brussels, the 1%, the neo-aristocracy, any way you want to put it, if the people vote against that, Brussels will strike it down, or they will just legislate around it, or they will just ignore it. We saw it most famously with Greece in...
Exactly.
And but people think, well, France is not Greece. France is, you know, 8 times the size. France is mighty France. You know, Greece's heyday was, you know, 2,500 years ago.
Right.
No, France is just like Greece. They are, the French people are as powerless as the, you know, Greek people. And this is something that, you might find this interesting.
Right.
Because you were talking about how the EU is the result of peace. Part of being PC in Europe is to not criticize the EU project because you're being then assaulted as, you know, a modern fascist.
Right.
Which is going back to what we're saying, how the definitions of left and right are immutable, historical.
Ramin Mazari, thank you so much for our conversation. Until the next time on Insight.
Thank you.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Ramin Mazari? France is experiencing a deep social and political crisis. Following the Lisbon Treaty and in the context of European integration, a loss of national sovereignty has occurred in which the power of the national government is limited to the imposition of austerity measures in order to remain in good standing with the EU and the global financial and banking system. Like in most other European countries, political parties and currents in France have lost credibility with the voters, as the traditional left-wing and right-wing parties abandoned their core beliefs and supporters and morphed into cynical neoliberal elite parties, virtually indistinguishable from one another. Traditional working-class voters increasingly voted for nationalist parties and currents. But as the last presidential elections in France showed, even these parties are dropping some of their core beliefs, like Euroscepticism, and adopting positions to attract voters in order to maintain whatever power they have gained in the preceding years. The presidency of Emmanuel Macron has become the symbol of this artificially imposed neoliberal order on a population which consistently rejects most of the austerity agenda being imposed, regularly protests this state of affairs in the streets, and continues to vote for anti-establishment parties. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. America's deployment of nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to the Royal Australian Air Force Base in Australia's Northern Territories is likely to fuel tensions with China. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. An expanded Royal Australian Air Force base in the Northern Territories of Australia will have space for up to 6 American nuclear-capable B-52 aircraft as part of a US-funded project that is likely to fuel tensions with China. Officials in Canberra confirmed that the US-funded aircraft parking apron at the Royal Australian Air Force Base Tyndall, 320 kilometres southeast of Darwin, would be capable of accommodating up to six B-52 aircraft, but said it could also house other aircraft types. They said the project was currently in the design phase and played down the significance of the development, saying American bomber aircraft had been visiting Australia since the early 1980s and conducting training in Australia since 2005. But the detailed plans, first reported by ABC on Monday, suggest the new Labor government in Australia has locked in plans initiated under the former coalition government to expand visits to Australia by US aircraft. The B-52 is a long-range heavy bomber that can carry out ocean surveillance and anti-ship operations and can carry nuclear or precision-guided conventional ordnance, according to a US government summary. Four Corners reported the US Department of Defense, the Pentagon, had budgeted $14.4 million for squadron operations and maintenance of facilities at Tyndall. It cited US documents as saying, "The squadron operation facilities required to support strategic operations and to run multiple 15-day training exercises during the Northern Territory dry season for deployed B-52 squadrons." The Minister for Defence Personnel, Matt Keogh, said Australia must remain vigilant amid regional tensions, but he did not think the B-52 rotation plans would inflame tensions with China. The Minister for Defence Personnel, Matt Keogh, said, "I don't think so at all. I think what's really important here is that the more we are able to build interoperability with the Americans, growing on that very strong alliance." America's ambassador to Australia, Caroline Kennedy, avoided commenting directly on the B-52 plans on Monday, but said the United States was determined to support peace and stability throughout this region through diplomacy, dialogue and deterrence. In an interview with ABC News Breakfast, US Ambassador to Australia Caroline Kennedy said the Indo-Pacific was facing increasing tensions and the United States would work with our partners and allies to make this region safe. Former Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison revealed in September of last year that he expected the United States to increase its military presence in the region while Australia awaits nuclear-powered submarines under the AUKUS deal, the first of which were at that stage expected to be ready by late 2030s. Senior ministers Peter Dutton and Maurice Payne held annual talks with their US counterparts in Washington, D.C., a day after the AUKUS announcement, and also flagged plans for more US military deployments to Australia. Senior Minister Peter Dutton said the alliance with the United States must be match fit to meet the strategic challenges ahead and announced greater air cooperation through rotational deployments of all types of US military aircraft to Australia, including strategic bombers. Sky News Australia has also covered the same story, giving us more details. Australia has dismissed outbursts from China over its decision to develop nuclear-powered submarines and flagged plans for more US military deployments in Australia. The Chinese embassy in Canberra has in turn accused the Australian government of sliding further down on the road of harming China-Australia relations and of lacking independence from the United States. Speaking after talks with the Biden administration in Washington, The Australian Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, said the nation was a proud democracy in our region and no amount of propaganda can dismiss the facts. The Australian government also renewed its request to China to resume high-level talks, an offer that the Australian Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, said mature actors would be prepared to take up. The Australian Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, and Maurice Payne joined their US counterparts for the annual dialogue known as AUSMIN, the first since the Biden administration took office. But it was overshadowed by the fallout from the announcement of the security pact among Australia, United States and the United Kingdom, the AUKUS pact. The deal has resulted in Australia tearing up its $90 billion contract with France for diesel submarines, and will instead see the United States and Britain share sensitive technology with Australia to let it develop its first nuclear-powered submarines. The Chinese government said the extremely irresponsible deal would seriously undermine regional peace and stability, while the tabloid, the Global Times, carried an editorial warning Australia not to act provocatively, or China would certainly punish it with no mercy. The Australian Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, dismissed the reaction from Beijing. Peter Dutton said, "This is not the first time that we've seen different outbursts from China in terms of Australia's position. We stand with our neighbours in the Indo-Pacific to ensure enduring peace, and this collaboration makes it a safer region. That's the reality, and no amount of propaganda can dismiss the facts." A joint statement issued by Australia and the United States criticised China's expansive maritime claims in the South China Sea that are without a legal basis. A Chinese embassy spokesperson rejected the unfounded accusations and erroneous remarks against China by both Australia and the United States. The Chinese embassy spokesperson said this petty move to put pressure on China will be of no avail, but a stage farce.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A special meeting has been held by the UN, titled UN Security Council Counterterrorism. The focus was on technology and the rapid rise in digitization, the use of new and emerging technologies to counter terrorism. In the meeting, the UN cited the important roles that victims and their networks can play in countering terrorism, and to pay tribute to India and how it was a terrorism victim back in 2008.
Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, let me extend a warm welcome to all of you in Mumbai, the financial capital of India, for attending this soft opening of the special meeting of the Counter-Terrorism Committee of the Security Council, as well as the informal briefing on countering the financing of terrorism in national and regional context.
Yet there was one country that was not mentioned, one which has been a victim of terrorism, one which was a victim of a terrorist attack just the day before, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. representative at the UN, Chris Liu, said things like, "Today was a powerful reminder that this is really about people's lives." He also said, "We send our sympathies to the Indian people. We stand in solidarity with them, and we are committed to ensuring that the perpetrators of this horrific attack are brought to justice. But no mention of Iran, especially since it lost 13 lives due to a terrorist attack, or the over 17,000 lives that it lost due to the MKO terrorist cult. Not that Iran was looking for sympathy from the U.S. After all, Iran's top intelligence bodies issued a joint statement just yesterday pointing to the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the violent riots in Iran in the past weeks. The announcement said intelligence evidence shows that the CIA had devised an extensive plan with the cooperation of allied spy services and reactionary proxies before the start of the unrest to initiate a nationwide chaos with the aim of committing crimes against the great Iranian nation. In short, the intelligence ministries said the CIA played the main role while closely cooperating with the spy agencies of the UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. This should not come as a surprise, especially since the U.S. has executed color revolutions. In short, exporting wars, launching color revolutions, fomenting extremist ideologies, and promoting economic instability, especially through sanctions, are just some of the actions by the U.S. which has resulted in bloodshed and turmoil around the world. Some of those countries include Cuba, Ukraine, Syria, Iran, and Venezuela. Here is a man who has openly advocated for support for these rioters and who has said that the U.S. has been involved in U.S. regime change operations. Former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat, yeah. Not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol. As to that, there's no doubt.
But Iran has been one of the biggest victims of terrorism. Deputy Chief of Iran's Judiciary and head of the country's human rights headquarters, Kazem Gharibabadi, has blamed Western countries for their double standard policies on terrorism and described his nation as the biggest victim of terrorism. He said on the one hand, they accuse Iran of violating human rights, but on the other, they martyr 17,000 innocent Iranian citizens through terrorism or violate the rights of millions of Iranians through the imposition of unilateral sanctions and jeopardize their right to life. The U.S. administration and its allies are now looking to convene an informal private meeting of the U.N. Security Council on recent Iranian riots as an attempt to advance their political agenda. Imagine that, the ones committing instability in Iran to then discuss Iran's domestic affairs, among them the recent violent riots. The Iranian reaction has been swift. Iran's permanent mission to the U.N. said, given the hypocrisy and the use of double standards and selective practice of human rights, we regard American claims in support of Iranian women to be deceptive and lacking in good faith. He also stressed that based on reports by Iran's intelligence community, the U.S. itself was the main suspect behind the recent riots in Iran. And to make the situation even more hypocritical, according to a note outlining the events, it said it's the U.S. and Albania which will hold the informal U.N. Security Council gathering to happen on Wednesday. Of all countries, Albania, which has for years hosted anti-Iran terrorists in collusion with the U.S., the MKO, the same terrorist cult which the U.S. named as a terrorist entity once, but then took that label away. Albania does not only host this terrorist cult, but it has turned its country into a hub of interference by the terrorist group and countries hostile to Iran. It enjoys freedom of activity, even after being delisted by the European Union and the U.S. in 2009 and 2012, respectively, of the terrorist label. So it came as no surprise that the MKO terrorist cult was also actively involved in the recent riots in Iran. The findings of Iran's top intelligence body said that 49 MKO terrorists had been arrested. The terrorists were responsible for spreading fake news, instructing rioters to organize acts of terror and destruction, to direct slogans, and to be present on the streets to damage public property. This was in addition to the 77 members of anti-Iran terrorist groups that had also been arrested in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. 5 members of the Takfiri terrorist groups were also arrested in possession of 36 kilograms of explosives that were to be used to carry out bombings and gatherings. The ministry has further announced that 92 people affiliated with the former U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime had been arrested. They added that 9 nationals from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden were also arrested during the riots. Iranian intelligence ministry said a significant number of pistols, various types of machine guns and cartridges, as well as shotguns and ammunition were also seized. So it is quite hypocritical that the U.S. and its European allies impose sanctions on Iran for what they claim is a heavy-handed crackdown on violent protesters, and then move to convene a UN session on how to ratchet up further pressure on the Iranian government. Hypocritical also, since the U.S. and these European countries have all been doing the same to their own population, especially the U.S.
After the Friday prayers, people of Iran poured into the streets to express their disgust at the heinous act of terror by Daesh Takfiri terrorists and ask for revenge against the group. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has already assured the nation that the perpetrators will face due punishment. President Ebrahim Raisi has also said that the root cause of the crime has been identified and that Iran will deliver a decisive blow to the architects and operatives of this plot, a blow that will make them regret ever committing such act. Daesh had already tried to pull off similar terrorist attacks in the country when they plotted the parliament attack and the bombing of Ayatollah Khomeini's mausoleum that left a dozen Iranians dead. Iran's anti-terror attacks ramped up significantly following the attacks on its soil through Iran's martyred anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. While these were the only attacks on Iran claimed by Daesh, there have been several other terrorist attacks by other, more globally obscure but equally vicious groups. Among them, the Mojahideen-e-Khalq organization, or the MKO, has the highest body count. 17,000 Iranians have died at the hands of the vile group that even joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war to carry out cross-border attacks. For years, the group was even on the U.S. list of terrorist groups before it was removed from the list in 2012 to receive funding more easily. Funding such as the massive annual events that the MKO manages to organize without having any backing by the people of Iran, neither inside the country nor outside. These events are often attended by top U.S. officials such as Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, or a number of British members of parliament to at least attempt to give the so-called Free Iran Conventions the legitimacy it sorely lacks. Among other terrorist groups that, while definitely not on the scale of the previously mentioned two, have still tried to deprive Iran of its security, we can name Jundallah terrorist group led by Abdul Malik Righi. Righi's group was responsible for the death of tens of Iranians in the southeast province of Sistan and Baluchistan before he was arrested and executed by Iranian authorities. Separatist groups such as Al-Ahwaziyya and the Kurdish Komala have also been responsible for a few terrorist attacks in the west of Iran, with the latter serving a prominent role in the recent riots across the country. But their plot to capitalize on the riots to further their separatist agendas was quickly foiled by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC carried out 2 ballistic missile attacks on Komala's bases in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC had warned Iraq prior to the attack that Iran will not tolerate the existence of such groups who were, as reported by the IRGC, plotting to attack Western Iran in its neighborhood. According to a joint statement between Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and the intelligence organization of the IRGC, involvement of the U.S. in the recent riots in Iran has been proven. The U.S. and its spy agencies have even branched out their plans in 3 stages: before, during, and after the unrests. The CIA is referred to in the joint statement as the main culprit for inciting the riots. But the CIA is aided by Israel's Mossad and Saudi Foreign Intelligence Services, with the help of the most vicious of terrorist groups. Inciting despair among the Iranian population with the help of the massive amounts of funding that is given to foreign Farsi-speaking media outlets is listed among the primary tactics used to incite the unrests. Teaching effective escalation tactics during unrests have also been documented as another tactic used by these spy agencies. But among the many other items listed, none of them would be possible without the massive funding that the US, UK, Israel, and their Saudi allies give to the media outlets and individuals who capitalize on people's emotions. Also, supposedly international platforms such as Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter freely violate their own rules in this particular case and allow posts that incite violence to be freely uploaded onto their platforms. An extra $53 million have also been allocated by the CIA to give to these Farsi-speaking media outlets and individuals on top of their annual payments. Israeli influence, however, should not be ignored. Just recently, the IRGC dismantled a network of Mossad-affiliated terrorists in West Azerbaijan province. The investment of these spy agencies in inciting unrest in Iran has been proven time and time again, and cannot possibly fit into a short clip. Rest assured, you will hear about more evidence of foreign meddling in Iran's recent riots in the days and weeks to come.
Tehran has once again rejected baseless accusations about Iranian-made drones being used in the Ukraine war. The Islamic Republic's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, has clearly stated that Tehran would not remain indifferent if it is proven that Iranian drones are being used in the war in Ukraine against people. The top Iranian diplomat had previously stated that Tehran and Moscow have defensive cooperation, saying it's not Iran's policy to provide Russia with weapons and drones to be used in Ukraine. Tehran has time and again clearly stated its opposition to war and any escalation of conflict, urging self-restraint on both sides. Iranian officials say the allegations leveled against the country stem from an ongoing Western campaign to pressure the Islamic Republic. Russian officials have echoed similar remarks.
Everything that is now being done on the Iranian track is subordinated to one goal, pressure on this country. And Washington is mobilizing NATO and EU countries for this in support of its position.
Also, the US, EU, and UK have moved to impose sanctions on Iran over the baseless accusations, supporting the notion that the West only wants to put more pressure on Iran. Meanwhile, Britain, France, and Germany have called on the UN to investigate the allegation. But Iran's ambassador to the UN has described the possible probe as illegal within the framework of Resolution 2231. In a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antony Guterres, Amir Saidi Ravani argued that the UN arms embargo on Iran mentioned in the resolution has expired in 2020, saying this means no Iranian sale or transfer of weapons or related materials to other countries is ever since subject to the resolution. The Iranian diplomat also urged the international body not to act based on the anti-Iran allegations by Western countries. Meanwhile, Russia had described the claims by the Western states as conspiracy theories, warning the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran, and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia for the use in the conflict in Ukraine.
Moscow has warned that it would reassess its cooperation with the world body if it carries out an investigation into the origins of the drones. Tehran has dismissed accusations by some Western countries and their media outlets that it provided weapons, including drones, to Russia for deployment against Ukraine. Iran's foreign ministry has called the allegations unfounded and made on the basis of misinformation and ill-intentioned presumptions. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July, with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleging that Washington had received information indicating that the Islamic Republic was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred drones, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline for use in the war in Ukraine. However, the Pentagon said it could not confirm the transfer of any Iranian weaponry to Russia. Since the very beginning, Iran rejected the claims, with the country's foreign ministry stating Tehran's preparedness to hold dialogue with Ukraine towards nullification of the allegations. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has even proposed a joint meeting between Iranian and Ukrainian military personnel and experts to review battlefield evidence of Iranian drones used by Russia in Ukraine. Despite that, Kyiv and its allies repeated the baseless American narrative without providing any evidence. The US, EU, and UK imposed sanctions against the country. So, if Kyiv and the West are so sure, then why are they reluctant to provide detailed evidence that supports their claims? Plus, while Iran has managed to advance its defensive capabilities despite US sanctions, is Washington using Ukraine as a false pretext to bring the Europeans along in a bid to impose an arms embargo against Iran to hamper the country's progress in the defense sector?
Iran has witnessed a deadly terrorist attack. The carnage happened at a holy shrine in the south-central city of Shiraz in Fars province. It left over a dozen people dead, including women and children. Over two dozen people were also injured in the attack. The bloodbath happened at the Shah Cheragh Shrine, which is one of the popular pilgrimage sites in Iran. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. The gunman shot his way into the shrine through one of the entrances. He then headed to the main compound, where he opened fire at pilgrims and staff. Eyewitnesses have told reporters that loud screams were heard in the women's section of the shrine at prayer time, when suddenly an armed man was spotted with a Kalashnikov firing indiscriminately in the compound of the shrine. Officials say the perpetrator is a non-Iranian national who has been arrested. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyidali Khamenei, has issued a statement on the incident, saying that strong action must be taken to identify and tackle the root causes of such heinous crimes. The leader said that all people and entities in the country are responsible in the face of seditious acts by the enemy and their traitorous or ignorant stooges. He advised everyone to stay united against those undermining the people's security and disrespecting their sanctities. Iran says the attack is part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian says that Tehran has reliable information that shows that terrorists and foreign meddlers have created a multi-layered scheme to make the country insecure. He says this latest attack has unraveled the sinister intentions of those promoting terror and violence in Iran. Earlier, President Ebrahim Raisi expressed his condolences to the families of the pilgrims who were killed or injured in the attack.
These riots paved the way for terrorist attacks. They came to Shah Cheragh Mausoleum and sprayed with bullets innocent people who were worshipping God. The ground for such terrorist attacks was prepared by riots.
The carnage in Iran has sparked a wave of condemnation. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly censored the attack and called for bringing the perpetrators to justice. Syrian Foreign Ministry has called the mass shooting a cowardly act, while blaming the U.S. for using terror attacks as a tool to coerce nations into submission. Russia and China have also condemned the carnage. And Pakistan's Foreign Office spokesperson and the Speaker of the National Assembly have condemned the attack, saying the people of Pakistan share the grief of the Iranian nation. Sayyid Ammar al-Hakim, the head of Iraq's National Wisdom Coalition, also decried the attack. Iranian officials say the terrorist attack has revealed the actual extent of the enemy's cruelty. It comes against the backdrop of the latest foreign-backed riots, which erupted after a young woman, Mahsa Amini, died in the hospital 3 days after she collapsed in police custody. Iran has denounced the silence of human rights organizations on the terrorist crime in Shiraz. It says the terrorists based in the U.S. and Europe enjoy unwavering backing there, and Western countries refused to publicly condemn terrorist incidents inside of Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that the suspicious death of Imam Khomeini's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, was a serious event in the course of the Islamic Revolution and highly impacted the family members of the Imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini himself treated the event very calmly as if nothing had happened. Today, we are going to speak to you on the Imam's departure to Paris. Stay with us, please. As the family of Imam Khomeini was getting prepared for the first anniversary of Haj Aqa Mustafa's martyrdom, the Ba'athist regime in Iraq decided to expel the Imam. Imam Khomeini, however, was not intent to capitulate to the demands of the Iraqi regime. Thus, he made up his mind to go to Kuwait. But the Kuwaiti government was forced by the Iranian dictatorial regime to reject the Imam's request. Therefore, after a brief stay on the Kuwaiti border, Imam Khomeini consulted with Haj Ahmad and accepted to go to Paris. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, says, "The night when the Imam wanted to leave for Kuwait was a strange night. Everyone was at our home. Everywhere was quiet. We slept at 12. Nearly 2 hours later, the Imam woke up for midnight prayer. It was peculiar. As soon as the Imam got up, everyone got up except children, as if no one had slept. Imam Khomeini got up to do his routine night job, ritual, ablution, midnight prayer, supplication and recitation of Quran. At that night, everyone was performing midnight prayer. Ahmad went to inform the friends who were supposed to accompany the Imam to Kuwait. He found all of them from the alleys of Najaf. They too had either not slept the night or just had fearfully taken a rest for an hour. Everybody was ready. Ahmad asked the Imam, 'Shall we not go?' The Imam answered, 'A quarter is left to the due time.'" Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, left Iraq without his wife and other women of his family. The women were supposed to stay in Najaf until conditions would become proper for joining the Imam. Lady Saghafi relates the story of the night when the Imam left them. "Everyone was doing something. I was preparing the foodstuff for the journey. Bread, cheese, walnut, and cuckoo. Imam Khomeini bid farewell to everyone. When it was my turn, he cast a deep look at me and said, 'I put you under God's care. It is nothing. We cannot disobey God. These people want to force me to give in. But pray that we move in the right way.' I led the Imam pass under the Quran, and Ahmad followed him. she continues, for 3 days the workers outdoors thought that the imam is at home. On the third day, when our Afghani worker understood that what happened, he wept so intensively. At first, I thought that they knew and was surprised as I saw no reaction from them. Then it was clear that they had not known. The house was plunged in silence. Everyone went to a corner. Some were crying quietly. Their pillows were plunged in tears, but there was no voice. Nobody had heard the sound of our hearts breaking. The departure of Imam Khomeini and the unknown future condition was very worrisome for his family, particularly for his wife. Nevertheless, some of their friends not only didn't help them to endure tough conditions better, but they added salt to their injury by censuring them. The imam's wife recounts, when the imam left Najaf for Kuwait and then Paris, some of the wives of ulema asked, why did the imam do this? Isn't it a pity to leave the holy Najaf and go to the land of disbelief? How can one compare the divine neighborhood of Imam Ali with Paris, the land of debauchery and unfaith? It was meaningless for them to see a source of emulation to go to France, as they didn't find it rational. For them, it was better to die in Najaf, even if it was with silence against the oppression, to living freely in Paris. Some of them thought that what made the Imam to go to Paris was his inattention to other sources of emulation, so that it would be said in history he acted differently to become conspicuous among others. Ms. Saghafi relates her last pilgrimage to the shrine of Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace upon them. Any time that I went on pilgrimage of Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abul Fazl, I would ask them to accept me once more to visit them. I would pray and they would accept. But the last time I forgot to ask them my usual request, thus I didn't find the opportunity to visit them anymore. 10 days after Imam Khomeini's departure to Kuwait and Paris, the preparations were made for the trip of his wife and other members of the family. The imam's wife says, upon the imam's departure, we started collecting everything to join him after holding the first anniversary of my son's martyrdom. I had no sorrow except leaving my son. Ahmad telephoned me and told me to go to France with Hussein. The tickets were taken for 4 days later, and we spent 4 days to gather everything. We would spend the nights to bid farewell to the commander of the faithful and my son Mustafa. I couldn't go to Karbala anymore. On the 14th of Dhulqa'dah, we left Najaf for Paris. I and my grandson Hussein went to Paris and then to Nufal Chateau. Ahmad welcomed us at the airport. We had the lunch at Mr. Karim Khoda Panahi's home and went to the imam in the afternoon. 3 days later, a house was taken for us. It was the house of Mr. Askari. It was the so-called bureau. The little appliances that had been prepared also belonged to the homeowner.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Those who remember Allah. This is the mark of someone who has an intellect. They remember Allah, standing, sitting, and laying on their sides. The Quran, Surah 3, verse 191. In other words, in every circumstance, they remember. However, remembering Allah here does not refer to the mystical trance-like state of the dervish that some people crave. Always remembering Allah, always chanting, Hu. But that is not what we mean. We mean actively remembering God. But what is it to actively remember God, such that His remembrance is counted as an act? How can one achieve this? And reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. Do you see? Those who have intellects, those who are truly wise, are those who ponder and think, and reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. And as they ponder on this, they say, whether inwardly in their hearts or outwardly with their tongues, Our Lord, You have not created this in vain. Immaculate are You. You have not created this without a purpose. You are too immaculate to have made this without a purpose. In other words, this is the most fundamental principle of their belief system or worldview.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Each and every worldview starts from a simple fact. We are here for some purpose. If you believe in God, you say you were created for a purpose. And if you do not believe in God, you say you have a purpose here. Do you see the most fundamental idea of a philosophy that is meant to inspire a way of life, whether for an individual or a society, is this: Our Lord, You have not created this in vain. He is a theist. He believes in God. So he says, Our Lord, You did not create heavens and the earth and all they contain for no reason. You are too immaculate and wise to do such a thing. Therefore, I have a moral responsibility. I must follow a path. I am but a speck among the wonders of the cosmos. But I am here for a reason. In this grand edifice, You have made a place for me and given me a purpose to fulfill. But I might disrupt the harmony of this system. Immaculate are You. So save us from the punishment of the fire. Whilst the fire of the resurrection is real, it is also a symbol of the fire of God's wrath, anger and retribution, and of the cosmos. You must pay attention to this because this is all a prelude so that we can apprehend the meaning of faith based on understanding from these verses.
Allah, I want to thank You. I want to thank You for all the things that You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
History repeats itself once more in Lebanon as President Michel Aoun steps out of a presidential palace which will remain vacant for an unknown period of time. Addressing flocks of supporters, Aoun said a chapter has ended in Lebanon's politics and a new chapter will begin.
A new phase begins, and this new phase requires struggle and work to exit our crises. The country is looted, and we have to carry out a lot of efforts to uproot corruption.
Aoun talked about the recent agreement with Israel to demarcate Lebanon's maritime borders. He said the deal secured the nation's access to its natural resources, adding that the future revenues should be used to repair the Lebanese economy.
The demarcation of our maritime border will allow us to extract the national treasure of petrol and gas, which would grant us the needed capital to come out of our economic and financial crisis. We hope to see a sovereign fund that would be used for development and also for the upcoming generations.
Aoun took office in 2016. His was marred by mass protests, a severe economic crisis, and currency collapse, and the August 2020 portside blast that killed hundreds. President Michel Aoun ends his term today at a time when Lebanon is deeply divided on various issues. But it was this term that has given Lebanon what experts are calling a golden opportunity to become a gas exporter and salvage its economy. President Aoun does not only leave behind a country without a head of state, but he goes back to his residency. The political divide remains quite entrenched, and experts see that the maritime border deal proves that the West has lifted its undeclared blockade on Lebanon.
In Lebanon, we are not usually good at seizing opportunities, but we benefited from the opportunity of demarcating the maritime border. Since there was a Western interest in having a stability in the Mediterranean region and allowing Lebanon to extract its resources. But will the Lebanese seize this opportunity to form an agreement which could result in the election of a president? We are waiting for the upcoming hours, which could evolve into security threats or perhaps surprises.
Lebanese lawmakers have failed to agree on electing a successor for Aoun, with no side having a clear majority to impose a candidate to succeed him. A caretaker government has been in place since the parliamentary elections last spring, and with no hope in forming a new cabinet in the last hours of Aoun's term, political divisions are expected to deepen until the election of a new president. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Wednesday's terror attack on Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine in Iran's city of Shiraz has saddened Iranians as well as many people around the globe. Among them, Afghans who have been bearing the brunt of blind terror attacks for years say the attack opened their old wounds. They say the tragic terror attack touched their hearts and they share the grief of Iranian people.
I express my condolences to all Iranians, particularly those who live in Shiraz, for their losses in the terrorist attack on Shah Cheragh Shrine. I was shocked and saddened that innocent worshippers were killed there. I also express my sympathy with families of victims. Iran has not been only our neighboring country and a friend of Afghanistan, but also a second home for we Afghans.
Indeed, it was a horrific and exhausting attack. We strongly condemn it. We Afghans can feel how terrifying such attacks can be. Of course, the attack on innocent people saddened all informed and civilized people. I hope the perpetrators and organizers of the attack are brought to justice and punished.
Afghan experts and activists stress the need for global unity, especially among Muslims, against terror acts. They believe the enemies of Islam and Muslims try to destabilize the region by sowing discord among its inhabitants.
The important point about the terror attack in Iran is that some countries who claim to be super